Okay, great. So the far future of cryptography. Next slide. Okay, great. So I think first, I mean, we'll talk about the very recent past and I think still ongoing present of cryptography, right? I think the biggest change that we've seen over the last few years is basically the way that snarks have really taken over everything, right? And one of the analogies that I've used is I've thought of snarks as being similar to a transformer, right? So this is you know, the GPT architecture that's now famous from AI land. And the analogy here is basically that if you think about what GPT did, right, it basically took a whole bunch of different use cases for which thousands of people have been putting in years of hard work, years of application-specific algorithms, application-specific data gathering, application-specific expertise, and it just like swept all of that away with just a really dumb system where you just like put like take half the internet, like throw it into a funnel, and then like run a bunch of GPUs for a while, and it just manages to magically outperform all of them as a general-purpose architecture, right? And snarks, you know, have done basically exactly that same thing for cryptography, right? So we've seen ring signatures, we've seen range proofs, you know, we've seen all kinds of different use cases just basically swept away and subsumed under this umbrella of I am just making a proof about a computation about private data that is expressed as some kind of standard arithmetic circuit in a standardized language, and that you can make a fairly short proof that just proves whatever claim you want to prove about private information that you have in zero knowledge. And oh, at the same time, it also solves scalability, right? So it's this extremely powerful general purpose technology, and the Ethereum roadmap has already changed completely as a result, right? So if you look at the plans that Ethereum has for the next few years, all of the far future stuff really depends on snarks existing. The roadmap for replacing Virkle trees with something quantum safe depends on snarks. The roadmap for long-term full light clients depends on snarks. The rollups started off being optimistic rollups, and now there's ZK rollups, and they demand on snarks or depend on snarks. There also Plasma before snarks. It was a very limited architecture that could only do a little bit. After snarks, it actually has become something quite a bit more powerful. So snarks have really overturned everything, and in a lot of ways, they've also simplified a lot of things, right? Like, if you remember trying to design protocols in the pre-snark era, like you really need specialized cryptographers putting in a lot of specialized cryptographic work to make specific applications work, whether it's range proofs or it's ring signatures or it's linkable ring signatures or it's Chalmian blinding. Every one of these primitives would require a cryptographic professional to do a whole bunch of work, and even still, you'd only make something that works for a few particular sets of applications. Snarks, non-cryptographers can just go in and they can do their thing, put in their code, and it just works. Next slide. So let's talk about what happens beyond snarks. So in one of my recent posts talking about the future of the Ethereum protocol, I made this analogy to these Egyptian god cards from Yu-Gi-Oh, right? These like extremely powerful monsters that just have these incredible powers, right? And you know, in Yu-Gi-Oh legend, these cards are so powerful that it's physically dangerous to actually attempt to create one of them, and you're not actually allowed to use them in duels, right? And like these three protocols, I think, are exactly that powerful in the same way, right? So we talked about snarks, but let's talk about the other two items in the series, right? So the one in the middle is fully homomorphic encryption. Fully homomorphic encryption lets you do any computation on encrypted data without being able to learn anything about that data. This is extremely powerful. This basically lets you take a very wide class of applications and just express them very easily as an FHE problem. I have private data, and I want you to do an run some algorithm on the private data and give me the results without actually learning my private data. That's an FHE problem. I want to be able to train on people's data without learning the data. That's also an FHE problem. You do need a little bit of cleverness to make sure that, like, the thing that the model actually learns about you doesn't actually itself reveal your data, and like that's a differential privacy thing, right? But the bulk of the hardness, like, actually is just captured by the FHE piece. If you want many kinds of like privacy preserving architectures, privacy preserving DAOs, as long as you're willing to accept a certain trust assumptions, it becomes an FHE problem. FHE is like actually an incredibly powerful technology. Another thing that it gives you actually is it gives you private information retrieval, so the ability to make queries against the database without the database learning what you're asking for. And one use case of this is privacy-preserving light clients, right? So you can have an Ethereum light client, and your light clients can go and like ask for like some piece of data about history without the server actually learning what you're asking for. So very powerful stuff. But you know, we also have to get to the third Egyptian god protocol, which is obfuscation, right? You can encrypt a program in such a way that the encrypted program has the exact same functionality, but if you have a copy of the encrypted program, you can learn nothing about the internals of it, like basically except for what the inputs and outputs are. Now, technically, like that exact definition is like not exactly achievable, but like in real, like for any realistic use case, it's like basically close enough to that, right? And so, obfuscation lets you actually do everything that FHE does, but it lets you kick out like even more of the trust assumptions, almost all of them. You can do DAOs that have secrets. You can actually use obfuscation to implement basically any other cryptographic protocol. You can use obfuscation to implement encrypted mempools. You can use obfuscation to implement a ZK SNARK scheme where verifying the SNARK only requires verifying a signature. It can let you implement like any kind of FHE MPC two-party computation. It like basically is a superset of like almost everything else cryptographic. So in order to try to make this a little bit more concrete, let's look at voting as an example, right? So I think of voting as an example because, I mean, obviously voting is important in itself. But also, voting to me is like a stand-in for basically any kind of on-chain mechanism that is not purely financialized, right? So, I mean, I wrote this is like one of my own frameworks, right? So, I wrote an article about this. I think this was the one on Nathan Schneider's crypto economics or coordination, good and bad. But what I call financialized is basically mechanisms where you don't mind people arbitrarily colluding. And one example of this is like if you compare money to, let's say, like likes on Reddit, right? If you think of money, I give you a dollar in exchange for you giving me a dollar is not a problem. It's working as intended. On Reddit or on Twitter, I upvote your post in exchange for you upvoting my post, especially if it got optimized to infinity, would just completely break the system, right? And so if you want to support any kind of mechanism that is not financialized, then like that means that you have to be able to prevent collusion in some way, at least make it difficult to trust. And that requires, as it turns out, exactly the same type of properties that voting requires. So let's look at voting as an example. So base case, put it on the blockchain. So what does putting it on the blockchain give you, right? It gives you public verifiability, so anyone can check that the result was computed correctly, and it gives you censorship resistance. If you're an eligible voter, no one can stop you from voting. So it's a good starting point. DAOs have been doing this for a very long time, very basic. Now, of course, voting on the blockchain has a lot of problems. So let's talk about adding cryptography on top. Let's add ZK SNARKs. Keep the previous properties, but you also add, and you keep public verifiability, but you, and you also have censorship resistance. Okay, sorry, I wrote this incorrectly. The thing that you add is privacy, right? Basically, if you vote, then no one will be able to tell who, like which person made a particular vote. You'll still be able to see the contents of the votes, but you will not be able to see like who actually made a particular vote. right? And this already is a very significant privacy gain. It already makes many types of collusion much harder, and like it's already a really significant improvement, right? But it's still not enough, right? And the reason it's still not enough is basically that if you really wanted to sell your vote, then if you made a ZK snark, you could still prove to someone else that you voted for some particular candidate very easily. So let's add the Macy mechanism. The Macy mechanism does not rely on any new cryptography. It keeps the previous properties, but it also adds coercion resistance, right? And assuming that the server is honest. So assuming that the server is honest, you add this new property, which is that you cannot prove who you voted for, even if you wanted to make that kind of proof. And this adds like a very large friction against actually trying to implement any of this kind of bribing, because basically, yeah, either they have to do some kind of like side channel attack against you directly as a voter, or they actually have to like attack the server. Now, let's add FHE, right? So with FHE, you keep the previous properties, but if you add FHE together with threshold decryption, you can make the coercion resistance guarantee only depend on an M of N assumption. So instead of relying on one operator, you can rely on potentially, like, say, 7 operators, out of which, like, 4 need to be, yeah, honest, right? Now, there are voting protocols that have existed since, like, 2002 that have given all of these properties depending on an M of N assumption with simpler technology, but those protocols, they gave all of these properties under that assumption. This kind of design actually gives every property except for coercion resistance an even stronger guarantee. And if you do it with general purpose cryptography, it generalizes much more naturally to any voting system. You're not, if you have a system that's designed for doing simple vote counting, you can switch it over to doing quadratic voting, quadratic funding with like a few lines of code. You can switch it over to doing pairwise bounded quadratic voting, a few lines of code. You can switch it over to doing cluster matching, a few lines of code. You can switch it over to doing the community notes bridging matrix factorization algorithm with only the lines of code that you need to actually implement that matrix factorization algorithm. I mean, if you want to do it efficiently, it's a bit hard, but the algorithm itself, like basically about 20 lines of code, right? So FHE, basically, together with SNARKs, you actually create this like very general purpose design, and you keep all of your all of these properties that you want out of a voting system, except coercion resistance depends on an M of N assumption, which is like not ideal, right? Because M out of N can still collude silently, and they can collude silently. They can like pass all of the information over to the NSA, and like no one would be able to actually tell that any collusion is happening. So now let's add obfuscation. So with obfuscation, you can keep the previous properties, but you can make it so that extracting or proving any information at all about individual votes requires blockchain consensus, and you can even make it require some amount of proof of work per bit of entropy that you extract. So how do you do this? Basically, when a user votes, instead of sending their vote to a threshold key, or FHE encrypting it to a threshold key, they FHE encrypt it to a key that is inside of an obfuscated program. And so this is a trusted setup, but there are ways to make the trusted setup be one of N, and you can make the N be like extremely large, right? So FHE encrypted into this key that's held inside of a program, and then that program only gives the total output of all of the votes. And in order to give the total output at all, and even there, it's not going to give the full number. It's just going to give like the one bit, basically who won, right? And or potentially a few more bits if it's like quadratic funding, right? And the way that this program works is it tallies the votes, and it also checks that there is a proof that the blockchain consensus finalized it. And on top of that, it also can check for like some little amount of proof of work, right? So you could do it like, say, like $500 worth of proof of work, or you could imagine like Ethereum eventually adding like maybe like $10,000 proof of work on every finalized block, or like some simple amount, right? And so then, even if the blockchain consensus colluded, even if like every everyone colluded, they would only be able to extract a very small number of bits of entropy from the system, right? And so actually, and then you can also make the program add a little bit of Gaussian noise, and so extracting any information about how an individual voter voted will basically just become extremely hard. So this is like very close to ideal, right? So, but there's more. So we'll talk about one-shot signatures. One-shot signatures are a primitive where you can have a key where that key can only be used in order to make one signature. One-shot signatures require users to have quantum computers. So this is a milestone that will come quite a bit after the bad guys have quantum computers, right? When quantum computers come, they're going to be like $100 million things. You know, the bad guys, or at least the people that we consider threats, will have them first, right? And so you'll have to wait quite a bit of time after that until regular users can also have quantum computers, right? But what you do is, what this is basically, you know, you can have a public key, and it's a mechanism by which it's a public key such that for any given nonce, you're only allowed, it's only possible for the owner of the private key to sign exactly one message with that nonce. And this all depends on the quantum no-cloning theorem, right? If you have a quantum state, then you cannot actually copy the quantum state. There's mathematical proofs that this is impossible. And the signature scheme depends on solving a problem which is infeasible with classical computers but doable with quantum computers. And so you're basically like proving that you have and that you're spending one of these unclonable quantum states. So this could actually be used to make quantum money without a blockchain. Now, it doesn't remove the need for blockchains completely. It still doesn't solve censorship resistance on its own. But this is the thing that, like, I don't want to call an Egyptian god protocol because, like, this is not just in the land of computer science. This is, like, in the land of physics, right? And so it's, like, it's some kind of tier that's, like, even more powerful than these things. So when will we get all of this technology, right? So zk-SNARKs, we're seeing an increasingly high level of maturity. I mean, I personally would declare victory once we're able to actually have zk-EVMs that are proving blocks within one slot. Currently, we're probably still like a couple of orders of magnitude away from this, but there's a huge amount of progress. There's a huge amount of work in binary field proving systems. Like basically, the race is on. FHE, we're starting to see viable applications. So if anyone here was at Edge City, you probably got one of those like square wristband things, and there was an application called Cursive where basically you could provide a list of what your interests are, someone else could provide a list of what their interests are, and it actually used FHE to compute the intersection. So we're starting to like see toy applications that like consumers can actually use on local devices. The FHE has roughly a million factor overhead, and so you can run business logic inside of it, but you can realistically you cannot run cryptography inside of it, right? So it's like at that interesting level where it's like good for some things, it's still not good for a lot of things. It's you know, in that middle zone. Obfuscation. The big news over the last few years is that we're starting to see viable protocols. In 2020, there was the first protocol that was dependent on only standard assumptions, and this protocol, someone actually tried to implement it, and they discovered that it would take 10 to the power of 27 years to run. A year later, someone created a slightly improved protocol, and someone else started to implement it, and they're estimating that it's going to take 1 year to run. Now, there's also a separate line of work that's trying to make obfuscation protocols based on slightly more exotic assumptions, and it's like actually more debatable in the long run whether this is more or less secure, right? Because it's like, on the one hand, you have more exotic lattice-based assumptions that are like based on multilinear map constructions and like zero testing and like that whole line of stuff. But on the other side, you have like normie assumptions about lattices. I mean, you know, go out and like ask a normie what they assume about lattices, right? That kind of stuff. But then at the same time, you have to like assume and elliptic curve pairings and like one or two other things, right? And so, but that stuff, you know, if you want to obfuscate a program, it takes like a couple of weeks, right? And then one-shot signature is obviously no idea, definitely a long time, and we'll see quantum computers break half of existing cryptography, including anything elliptic curve based, long before this actually becomes possible. So basically, I think the takeaway is that all this stuff that was like extreme science fiction a decade ago is like slowly coming into view, right? Every single piece is like, with every single passing year, is becoming slightly more and more clear. And I think we can actually really start getting excited about these things, right? And we get excited about a world where cryptography actually can get to the point of, in a general purpose way, actually being able to replicate or replace the functionality of any trusted third party. And I think that future will be amazing. Thank you.
Thank you, Vitalik. So we will do 3 minutes of Q&A. We have the QR code here you can scan to both add questions and upvote questions. There are only two questions so far, and one with, I'll start with the fun one, which is, Vitalik, have you played the frog game? And if yes, how many frogs have you collected?
Unfortunately, not this time. I've had like zero time to do anything other than jumping around DEF CON stuff. But here it's been fun. Okay, what advantages will the snarkification of the beacon chain have? I think the big one is basically that you will have light clients that will be able to fully verify the Ethereum protocol, right? So like on your phone, on your watch, anywhere that you want to do things with Ethereum, you'll be able to like actually fully verify the rules of the chain. And like you'll be part of the mechanism that ensures that the chain and like even 51% of the stakers are not changing the rules on you. And and this will all just like happen passively and automatically. To invite me to a conference to speak at, how does one go? I'm not answering. One shot signature on the book possible, not answering. Can we call Beamchain Ethereum 3.0? I think no. And I think this is like an important misconception, right? Because I think like a lot of people like got this weird Twitter impression that like, oh, you know, in the Beam chain, it will only happen in 2029, and it only gives you these nice ivory tower properties about the consensus layer, and so it doesn't even mean anything for users, and like this is Ethereum 3.0, right? And the reality is like very different from that, right? The Beam chain is only covering the Ethereum consensus layer, which is only like maybe 1/3 or 1/4 of the Ethereum stack, right? The execution layer, the EVM, has its own roadmap, and then layer 2s and layer 2 interoperability has its own roadmap. And even on the consensus side, all of the key things that are actually meaningful for users, so especially getting dank sharding up, I think can happen a lot sooner than 2029. Thank you. Okay, more questions. What do I think about CEEs? I mean, I think they're definitely interesting for some uses, though I think it's always important to remember that like they depend on a lot of trust in specific manufacturers and they get frequently broken, right? And so you want to use them for like applications where they're either just additive in terms of security or where the cost of them breaking is like not too high, but you don't actually want to use them to like literally replace cryptography. So, you know, use them responsibly. What can one-shot signatures plus obfuscation plus blockchain not do? It cannot give you true love. Thank you.
Thank you, Vitalik. So, while our next speaker is going to prepare the connection with their laptop, I've been sent to entertain you guys. So, one thing I find interesting with Vitalik's presentation is when you start listing down these cryptographic protocols one by one, you don't need to like squint your eyes that hard to kind of like see some form of mathematical computer emerge, right? Like each of these primitives are synergistic with each other. As an example, one primitive Vitalik did not talk about is ORAM, Oblivious RAM. And one thing that's interesting with that is the same way in traditional computers, we could put all of our state in CPU registers, but we don't because they're hella expensive. And we have, like, you do know, multiple layers of storage. We have CPU registers, RAM, block storage, network storage, etc. It's probably going to be the case that with cryptography, we will have to do the same. So while some of these protocols can technically do everything, we'll probably compose them with each other in order to like reap the best performance possible. And so who knows, maybe in a decade we will have cryptography computer engineers whose entire job is to build computers out of polynomials and not out of silicon. One thing I was thinking about yesterday night when I couldn't sleep is who's going to be the TSMC of cryptography, you know? Kind of like a polynomial constructor for hire. that put together the biggest cryptography computers. I will also check with AV if we're ready. We're ready? Okay, cool. So I will introduce our next speaker to the stage. So Albert Nie has been many things to many people at both the Ethereum Foundation and Zero X Park, but above all, he's someone who pushes us all to think in more direction, and I think he's going to do that yet once again with this talk, titled The Future of Cryptography, The Real, Surreal, and Super Real. Thank you, Albert.
Said we have to do this. There we go. All right. Hi, everyone. Thank you, Justin, for a very fitting intro. Today, above all, I want to share some interesting ways I think about the future of cryptography. Some, many perhaps, are ways people have not considered. This is going to go to some interesting places, as the title hints at. But before I dive in, I want to emphasize that while I want folks to consider more directions, the point is not to replace how you currently think about things. This is not new thinking in a totalizing sense. It's not declaring. It's not even predicting, at least not in the sense that people usually interpret the concept of talking about the future. This is just thinking, creating awareness for what may be possible and may be true, because sometimes that awareness is what makes something unexpectedly possible. We don't have much time, so I'm going to talk as fast as possible. Just kidding, but seriously, buckle up. So part one, the real. Let's start with some easy stuff, things many of you know if you've been exploring modern cryptography. Here are some slogans, if you will. Come for the encryption, stay for the signatures. Or come for the security, stay for the interoperability. Like today, HTTPS is a statement of security, but maybe ZTTPS or PCTP, Programmable Cryptography Transfer Protocol, will be a statement of possibility. How about this? Come for the nuke-proof paint, stay for the superconductor. We've known for a long time that cryptography is digital nuke-proof paint, but it's the superconductor aspect that we are only beginning to realize and understand. Now I want to go in a bit of a different direction. Here's a quote from Steve Jobs, recorded in the book Valley of Genius, an oral history of Silicon Valley that I'd highly recommend. One of many things that stands out from this quote is this phrase, medium of expression. Today, what is the thing that, this thing we call computer technology, what is it a medium of expression for? Consider all that's been built around computer technology. Especially the companies, the organizations, the products, the institutions. What are they expressing? Or, this is a bit more of a leading question, what have they become? Everyone senses something has gone a bit awry with our relationship with the digital, a relationship that's largely mediated by what we broadly call computer technology. And so, I want to take this immune system lens. When we think of the word immune system, we naturally think of our physical immune systems. This predates literally humanity itself, but for much of human history, there's also been this implicit notion of an intellectual immune system. You could also consider calling this a philosophical immune system. Think about how you respond intellectually to various things, how that's changed, developed over time. Sometimes it strengthens, sometimes it's probably weakened, kind of like your physical immune system. What about the digital? Right now, we think of digital stuff in terms of security and protection. But as our digitally anchored and oriented experiences become increasingly intertwined with our lives, perhaps the notion of an almost organic digital immune system is a way to think about it. Notably, a digital immune system conceptually wouldn't even have been cogent 100 years ago, probably less. It's simply much newer, almost primordial, so we need to remember it's going through things that are more associated with the very early stages of a system or ecosystem developing. For instance, one might say that the interaction between the physical and the digital currently leans parasitic. This is partly because we haven't realized the full potential of digital technologies and I guess the digital realm to be more symbiotic with our overall existence. But I think this can and inevitably will happen, especially as our intellectual immune systems co-develop or co-evolve with our digital immune systems. Remember, one of the most underrated things about evolution is that symbiotic coexistence is literally a more effective equilibrium than total takeover. This is true even when the specific organisms fundamentally remain in competition, such as predator and prey. If the predators start doing too well, they crowd each other out. Same goes for the prey. Now you might think, okay, cool, digital immune system, cryptography, that makes sense, the connection is relevant. But that's not exactly where I'm going. What I want to consider next is literacy. Consider this word and why it even exists. It used to be notable when someone was literate, as in could read or write. For most of history, it was rare, or definitely not universally expected for people to be literate. That's why the word exists, to point out an unexpected thing. Of course, today it's notable when someone is illiterate. It's not just notable, it kind of feels wrong, like society has failed that person. Keep this in mind. Going from default illiterate to default literate happens all the time, often slowly, then quickly. One of the most well-known company slogans of my childhood was from Bill Gates and Microsoft. As you can see, the slogan was, "A computer on every desk and in every home." 30-plus years ago, this sounded incredibly ambitious. It was almost awe-inspiring. As it turned out, this was nowhere near ambitious enough. Should have been a computer in every pocket, a computer with you at all times, a computer the first thing when you wake up, the last before you sleep, a computer while you're on the toilet, when you're in a meeting or attending a talk, a computer every fucking where at all fucking times. Computer literacy, as in being able to make use of a computer for your needs, was rare until very recently. When I was a kid, aptitude with computers was actually viewed as low status. Phrases like, "computers are for secretaries," were common. Today, everyone below a certain age is computer literate, but not in the way that you might have naively expected 25 years ago. And it's definitely not that everyone now knows how computers work. It's that computers became a thing everyone knew how to use, thanks in large part to the iPhone and the subsequent smartphone revolution. Again, default illiterate becomes default literate, but how it happens is often hard to predict. Even when the iPhone came out, many thought it was going to be a total flop. Consider also how the concept of photographic evidence has only existed for like 100 years. Imagine telling someone in 1850 that there's a photograph or video or audio recording to prove or disprove their version of events. Today, that idea is entirely second nature. Most of us have never known a world without it. Of course, there's a storm brewing with progress on what we call AI, because we don't know what else to call it. The current concept of photographic evidence definitely won't last another 100 years, might not even last 10. If you naively extrapolate, you might think we're going to revert to the world of trust me, bro, just like all of history before the photographic evidence era. But naive extrapolation almost never actually plays out. A couple generations from now, cryptographically grounded evidence will be second nature to people, the same way iPhones made computers second nature to kids today, the same way photographic evidence has been second nature for decades. But it's not even really the cryptographic evidence era. We kind of have that already to some extent. It's the cryptographic literacy era. Remember, literacy doesn't mean mastery, and widespread cryptographic literacy doesn't mean widespread understanding of how cryptography works. Similar to how I noted earlier that widespread computer literacy doesn't mean everyone knows how a computer works. Still, what's really going to happen is not actually going to be thought of as cryptographic literacy. What will it be thought of as? I consider this one of Vitalik's most underrated blog posts. Should be pretty easy to look it up, given the title. Within the post, Vitalik defined legitimacy as a pattern of higher order acceptance. Loosely speaking, people expecting other people to expect the same things, and therefore we can all expect something. Recall that smartphones are what unlocked computer literacy. They are the form and mechanism through which computer literacy became near universal. For cryptographic literacy, or legitimacy literacy, the form and mechanism is something we don't know yet. What is it that makes things more high order accepted in this broader sense? Product and technology innovations will unlock this future, and I bet some of them will feel just as surprising as the iPhone would have felt just 30 years ago to someone still being awed by Bill Gates' computer on every desk vision. Also remember, the value of the wheel, it was unlocked by the invention of the axle. People weren't idiots. They long noticed that round things can move more easily, but that's not what it takes to make use of the wheel. We don't know what the axles are to cryptography's wheels yet. One consequence of all this is that something that feels like cryptographic writing will exist. I'm sure it won't feel literally like writing combined with cryptographic signatures. In fact, we already have that. But what's important is it'll have the property of being inherently higher legitimacy than conventional digital writing. We will not think of all things written digitally as being more or less the same. This is already true to a limited extent, depending on the context, but the distinction will be much more substantial, and there will be a reflexive feedback loop that causes even more widespread legitimacy literacy throughout society. All of this will contribute to another shift in how people feel about cryptography, even if they don't know that's the thing that they're feeling something about. So everything so far I've put under the real. Now I want to start to segue towards the super real. To do that, first I want to revisit some miracles of science. Here I'll loosely define miracle as something where if you didn't know something existed or was possible, it would be very surprising that such a thing exists, just as it would be surprising if magic existed. My first example is fire. The existence isn't a surprise since it spontaneously occurs in nature, but the ability to control fire was a significant development, to say the least. Next is electricity. This one is a bit surprising. I guess people had seen lightning, but what reason was there to believe that this thing could be harnessed, that it would turn out to be magic juice that moves infinitely fast and basically gives us permanent light, communication across vast distances, or to be able to construct things like computers? Then there's nuclear power, which was, I think, truly a surprise. Like, wait a second, effectively infinite power is everywhere. Mass is literally energy. But there's one more source of quote-unquote power that gets overlooked because it's a fundamentally different type of power. Each of the first three miracle power sources can be viewed as asymmetric offense. It's a lot easier to burn something than to make it fireproof, and we know how powerful a nuclear weapon can be. But as I noted earlier, cryptography is digital nuke-proof paint. Cryptography is an almost infinitely powerful defensive or protective technology, and the fact that it's the digital superconductor is like the icing on the cake. So I do think it's reasonable to consider cryptography a miracle of science. And one reason is because cryptography is a physical realization of the potential of mathematics. Now, let's consider the four fundamental forces of the physical universe. We've got gravity, a force that was definitely apparent to humans since well before we were humans. Then there's the electromagnetic force, which was, the fact that that was a force was not actually really clear until about 200 years ago. Then we've got these two crazy forces that operate at atomic scales, the weak force and the strong force. We actually didn't even realize they existed until the 20th century, and we didn't confirm how the weak force functions until like 1960. So are we sure that we've got them all? There's even like a digital strong force, strong nuclear force parallel here. You know, cryptography holds things together at a level that overcomes the inherent collapse of digital data, kind of like the strong force overcomes the repulsion that positively charged protons otherwise would experience when packed together in an atomic nucleus. So that's why I wonder if it might be apt to think of cryptography as like a fifth fundamental force of the universe, especially a universe that is increasingly becoming a combination of the physical and the digital. And so that takes us to part two, the super real, and I like this particular definition of the word, marked by extraordinary vividness. So if cryptography is a force of nature, then to actually utilize that force requires implementation. Our day-to-day usage of electricity isn't just some like general usage of the electromagnetic force. You know, there's voltage, there's what decisions around batteries, alternating versus direct current, and so much more. There are a lot of specific things. So when I say cryptotricity here, what I'm gesturing at is the specific form that, of things that actually harnesses the cryptographic force. This is one reason I kind of like to think of cryptography as a digital dual to physical reality's electricity. The transition we're undergoing can be likened to the transition from a world that only knew fire to a world where electricity is everywhere. Back when people only knew fire, if someone told you about electricity, that we could somehow harness lightning, you might imagine better lights, better heat, perhaps better cooking, ironically, because fire is actually better than cooking for cooking in a lot of situations. You could imagine lighting up a city and heating a city, but you wouldn't really imagine powering a city. You wouldn't imagine computers, the internet, or that electricity actually kind of runs even through our brains. You definitely would not imagine artificial intelligence, and you definitely wouldn't imagine cryptography. So in the future, digital stuff, such as data, computation, information transmission, that makes use of programmable and other future cryptography will feel like electrically powered objects in comparison to what we have across the web today. Computing that is cryptographically charged, or maybe enchanted, is far from what we currently think of as computing. Same with data that is cryptographically enchanted, and beyond. Now, why is this even more important than it might seem at first blush? Because the tech industry, as of now, has philosophically flattened. In fact, we can see remnants of the higher dimensional space it fell from. If you look at any tech startup's pitch, they pretty much all still contain a mission, and the mission is never build the most valuable company. Now, if you've ever seen a hedge fund, like a new hedge fund's pitch deck, they never have a mission. It's all business. It's how they're going to make the most money. The whole tech company mission thing at this point is kind of a remnant from a philosophically higher dimensional era of Silicon Valley. And at the same time, and not coincidentally, while computer technology has improved dramatically, it has regressed from the standpoint of how it feels. Counterintuitively, using computers going back to like Doom or Civilization 1 or The Well or IRC or AIM or text-based multi-user dungeons in many ways felt more expansive and enriching. Not that things were anywhere near perfect back then, don't get me wrong, but there was a hard-to-quantify feeling of moreness that feels so different than how the web feels now. It's fascinating how differently and in some ways better I felt using a dial-up modem with terrible bandwidth and latency than I do now on my 5G pocket supercomputer. Now, a common response to this is technology is bad and we need less of it. I'm open to that perspective, but I don't think it should be a totalizing one. We've got to also explore how the digital can return to being an expansive and enriching experience. We've gone from it being symbiotic to parasitic. How do we go back to being symbiotic? That's the real game, and the future of cryptography plays a vital, necessary, though certainly not sufficient, role in this. And it's why looking at cryptography strictly through the lens of what it can technically do is incomplete. Instead, or in addition, I think we need lenses such as this. No one today thinks of cryptography in terms of nourishment. It might sound crazy, but I think we not only can, but perhaps must think of it in these terms, because only then can we potentially discover or realize that it's actually a valid way to think about it. We might even find out eventually it's the only natural way to think about it. And as for enrichment, this is a cryptocurrency conference, so I want to emphasize I'm saying enrich, you know, kind of like the soil got enriched and we were able to support much more people on Earth, not the other one. One last lens from the super real is, how can cryptography help us re-enchant the digital? It's not just now we can do programming on cryptography, even if that is very cool. It's that cryptography itself is fundamentally a bridge between math and physics, between the digital and the physical, and perhaps between computation and lived experience. So finally, I want to spend a quick few minutes on what I'm going to call the surreal. I've got a quote here from Italo Calvino that closes with, "If a new world were discovered now, would we be able to see it?" And the definition of surreal, a definition at least, is beyond reality. So I want to start somewhere, again, probably a bit unexpected. What's the greatest invention in the history of mathematics? In my opinion, it's the polynomial. The ancient Greeks, Romans, Chinese, they were all excellent at math, but they were held back by not having something like polynomial representation. But here's the interesting thing about polynomials. Even though they were invented close to 1,000 years ago, and even though they were instrumental to things even like the invention of calculus, we didn't really understand how awesome they were until around 200 years ago. What happened then? We got the first rigorous proofs of a theorem about polynomials that's so important we call it the fundamental theorem of algebra. The thing about the fundamental theorem of algebra is it doesn't even work if you only have real numbers. It only works when you have complex numbers. And it turns out polynomials are just one of many things that make way, way, way more sense with complex numbers. That's why I say the most unbelievable realization in the history of mathematics, and arguably the world, is that reality itself consists of more than just real numbers. That the real numbers were nowhere near all that was required to simply describe and reason about reality accurately. Complex numbers show up everywhere, from electronics to fluid dynamics to quantum mechanics and more. What's more, the reals themselves became more spectacular once we completed, or algebraically closed for those who are familiar with that notation, once we completed the reals to form the complex numbers. E goes from being the number that's defined as like the derivative of e to the x is still e to the x, to being a fundamental basis of rotation in the complex plane. Pi goes from circles being cool to being far more significant, in part because the set of points equidistant from the origin becomes far more interesting in a two-dimensional complex plane than on a one-dimensional number line where you just have x and negative x. And that's barely scratching the surface of examples. So consider this. If the real numbers aren't the full picture of reality, should we expect anything else to be? Does the digital, the internet, the web, and perhaps more not really make sense until we complete it with a unit of cryptography as the reals were to form the complex? If physical reality is built on physics, can we enrich a complex super reality by bringing elements of the physical into the digital realm, just as we've clearly brought elements of the digital into our physical existence? And can this be a symbiotic relationship? It almost can't not be to actually feel like super reality. Is there a complex big bang? Will it look like a Genesis block or something else? Is cryptography where silicon-based life really comes from? And what's more real? Places in the physical universe we can literally never reach. Like, we get light from places that are so far that if we traveled at the speed of light towards them, because the universe is expanding, we will literally never get there. What's more real? Those places or places in this perhaps more vast, complex reality that we actually can visit? And so the last thing I'll say is, in science fiction, you know, we see this phrase, outer world, sometimes. Will we one day think of outer realities? And I wonder, when we hear a voice from an outer reality, what we will look like by then, and who will be listening. And so I'll leave you with this final note as we take a few for Q&A. Thanks a lot for coming.
Thank you, Albert. So to start the Q&A session, the first question is, how does cryptography as a fifth force interface with the Fermi paradox? Are all the aliens encrypted?
Yeah, I love this question, actually, because I've always thought the Fermi paradox was a little bit simpler than people make it out to be, because the key is, why aren't we observing things? And given that, for example, we can observe an ant farm without it having any sense that we're observing them, there's a pretty big assumption that it should be like that easy to observe stuff out there. So that's not exactly what this question is saying, but I just kind of wanted to point that out. Like, what if you could cryptographically encrypt your mind onto like neutrinos and then flow through everything? Maybe that's happening right now, and maybe that's where things will go. So even just at that level, like, cryptography has helped me with my thinking around the Fermi paradox. Not saying that's the answer, but I think it's, people kind of skip over the whole like, oh, of course we'd be able to see it, even though it's like literally trivial for us to observe life that is probably closer to what we are than, you know, maybe more powerful intelligences are to us.
Thank you, Albert. Reminder that you can scan the QR code to ask questions. We still have 2 minutes of questions, so many things you can ask Albert. There's one question, one upvote, which is, what's your suggestion for individuals to contribute to this?
So this can mean a lot of things, right? It can mean, you know, a lot of the stuff that people are showing here, or it can mean the thing that I just talked about. But I will actually focus on what I just talked about. I think, as simplistic as it sounds, my goal here is for people to recognize that sometimes just taking a moment to think about things can be surprisingly valuable. That sounds really obvious, and yet, like, how much time is spent trying to just take a moment and think? And the talk here, the goal of nothing else, was to give an example of how many directions that can go in, and not in a way where I'm like, I'm trying to convince you of something or sell something or anything else like that. So I think you may be able to contribute more than you expect by just taking a moment to think about what you know and what and your perspective, and see how that might intermingle with stuff. As for other ways, I think there's a lot of great opportunities to ask folks about that overall, so we'll go to the next one.
Thank you. Anyone you care more about, we want to answer?
Sure, I'll go with, how do you see cryptography contributing to an internet that is joyful, symbiotic, and expansive to use? I don't have much time, but the quick answer here is, the physical world has a lot of properties we take for granted, and if nothing else, we're evolved to like orient around that. Even the fact that like non-fungibility is like default on in the physical world, and we need like sophisticated constructions to make things like essentially fungible. Like, words are fungible in a sense. Two apples are more or less fungible. That's only because we've gotten good at putting them all in a market, and so on. The digital world has like these inversion of a lot of properties. So if nothing else, I think cryptography is underrated in its potential to enrich, because it's a way for us to imbue the digital world with physical world properties, and that's a lens that I think we haven't really explored much yet. Yeah, there's the fungibility, scarcity stuff, but I think there's a lot more to go in that direction.
Thank you, Albert. Thank you. Another round of applause for Albert, please. Thank you. All right, so we have a special treat next. Our next speaker is Barry Whitehat, a self-proclaimed street cryptographer, a longtime collaborator with the EF and Xerox Spark. Barry will whiteboard out his thoughts on how to build with I/O and more. Always a treat to hear what he's cooking up. Please welcome to the stage Barry Whitehat. Thank you.
Hi. Okay, folks, can you hear me? Okay, we're gonna do some whiteboarding stuff. So like basically the plan for today is to like architect some simple things using I/O. Can I turn this around? So like, do people have things that they would want to architect? So like, a couple of things I was thinking about doing is like how to use I/O to make zero knowledge proofs that are just like a single signature to verify. So you have this I/O box, it does some stuff and it spits out a signature, and like once you check the signatures, it's enough to say to know that that computation was done correctly. So that's one thing that we could do. Other things we could do is like a trusted setup. Other things we could do is we could do like a Bitcoin bridge, which is kind of more blockchain-y. Anything else people want to do? This is supposed to be like interactive, so feel free to like shout stuff out and interrupt me. Like I want to have more of like a conversation here than like a presentation. Oh no, that's too much. Can I encrypt my thoughts and send them as neutrinos across the galaxy? Not today. Anything else? Okay, well, if there's nothing, like, just shout at me later. I'll ask you again in a while. So let me turn this around. Oh yeah, it's okay. Okay, so basically the toolbox of I/O is that we have like some program that we express as like gates. And we have some ins and some outs. And then we do like the I/O thing. We do this I/O kind of like almost like encryption step. And on the other side, we get like a whole bunch more gates or more information. And it still has ins and outs, but like what's happening in the middle is impossible for us to figure out. So this, you can think of this as like an encryption step that takes a program, it encrypts the program such that the output is like unknowable. It's like all you can do is like put stuff in and get the outs, and you can like see stuff that's going in and coming out, but you can't figure out like what the original program is. So one example of this. Okay, so let's take like a really simple example, and let's say that our gate here is just like a AND gate. Yeah, so we have a really simple program as an AND gate, and we put it into our I/O encryption box. Box I/O, and then we get out this like more complicated representation, right? So this is also just like a list of like operations, like maybe it's matrix multiplications. That's what schemes ADP and matrix branching programs tend to use. But maybe it's just like other binary gates. That's the local mixing schemes tend to use those. So we get this encrypted format of our program, but we have like black box access to it, right? So we can put inputs and we can get outputs. So like this one takes just two inputs, but there's like a whole bunch more gates here. And the gates are really complicated. So we don't know what's happening inside our circuit, but we are able to do like black box access. So I can just put like, because there's only two inputs, I can just calculate the whole truth table, right? Because I have the encrypted program, I can just put in 0, 0, and I get out, I don't know what the truth table of AND gate is. Well, let me try and guess. So 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1. Okay, that's it, source of truth. This is an AND gate. Okay, so we can just like, these are ins. Okay, so we can just put that in and like, that's XOR. Oh fuck. Huh? We good? Yeah. Okay. Okay. So we can just go through and like do the whole state space enumeration, and we can find out the truth table. But we don't know if this is actually an AND gate or if it's a more complicated circuit. But like, what I'm getting at here is that like you're able to. You have black box access to the thing, right? Like, the goal here is to try and build up this model so you're able to sit down and be like, I can imagine how to make things with I/O. Okay, cool. Okay, so let's do our first example then of our ZKP. Right. Because like, I don't know if you've seen the kind of like tree of the tech tree of different cryptographic primitives, but IO is kind of the one at the very top because you can use it to implement all of the others. So like as a way to just introduce the concept, let's do ZKPs. Okay. So let's say that like, let's introduce this other model of how to think about it. So we have our setup, which is what we just talked about. And now let's talk about like how we think about the IO box. So we have this IO box. Okay? The IO box does some things, right? So the first thing that it does is we can define some computation we want it to do. And then given that the computation succeeds, we get the IO box to produce a signature. So this is kind of like an if. If computation, I have to move over to the other side, then produce a signature. So if the computation succeeds, then produce a signature. So like this IO box has been encrypted, and I have given it to you, right? So you have this box on your computer. You're able to give it any inputs. And the output you get is a signature of something, okay? Maybe the signature is, maybe we just signed the computation, right? So basically, if we want to make a zero knowledge proof, what we need to do is we need to, I have other colors. We need to take this computation, and we just set that to be whatever the thing we want to prove is, right? For example, if you want to prove that you have like 10 signatures from a certain public key, what you do is you take your IO box, you set the computation to be the verification of 10 signatures, and then you have this clause that like, well, if 10 signatures are here, produce this other signature and pass it out. So one important thing to remember is that we have a secret inside the IO box, yeah? So let's do secrets. We have secrets inside our IO box. And inside our IO box, what are our secret? Our secret is the secret key of this signature, right? And we have this, it's not a secret, we have the public key. So at the setup phase, what I do is I create this IO box, and I do the encryption step that we talked about on the previous slide. And now what I do is I publish the public key, and I say, hey, look, if you ever get something that's signed by this public key, you know that it has passed this check, right? Because the only way that you can produce this signature is if you execute the IO box. Okay, so this is how you do zero knowledge proofs. Do we have any questions so far? Yes, there we go. So the question is, how do you trust the output of the IO box if you don't know the computation? So like I'm using the computation as like a placeholder here. But like when you do the setup, you would define the computation and you would sort of show people that like, oh, this is the thing that I set up. So like IO inherently has this kind of like setup phase, which you can think of as like similar to the zero knowledge proof trusted setup, where you set up the circuit and you set up the program that you want to prove, but you also need to set up the kind of like private key, right? You set up the private key and you publish the public key, and this is like part of the setup that you need to go through. Good? Anything else? Okay. Oh, Jordy. Oh, no. Okay. All right. Later, Jordy. Okay, cool. So this is how you do zero knowledge proofs. So like a quick aside, is there any other things that people are interested in architecting? We have 10 minutes, so I have enough stuff to go through, but if there's something people are specifically interested in, we can think about them. Okay, well, feel free to interrupt me if something comes to... DAO signing things. Okay, let's do that then at the end. So you want to have like a DAO that has a private key and it wants to sign things? But like, what's the point of doing that? Is it like you want to have an EOA? EOA is externally owned account, like a private key for a DAO. But like I don't like the reason I'm concerned about doing this is that like, well, you can just have the DAO be a smart contract and you can just verify the smart contract did something, as opposed to like verify the signature of something. But like maybe Jordy means that he wants to be able to have stuff encrypted for the DAO that the DAO can. Yeah. So Jordy's saying that he has an external file, he wants it to be encrypted, but he only wants you to be able to decrypt the file if you send funds to the DAO. Right.
Yeah, and nobody knows, I mean, this file was encrypted and nobody knows the key except the DAO.
Okay, this is kind of like, is this witness encryption? I'm not sure, but yeah, okay, we can do that. What was the other things I had written down here? Okay, trusted setup. Okay. So let's do the trusted setup, and then we'll talk about Jordy's thing. Okay. Okay. So. Okay. So historically, like we've done trusted setups for a whole bunch of different ZK applications, and this basically means that we like gather randomness from a whole bunch of different people, and then we compute this kind of like special key that has certain properties. And basically what I want to talk about now is how we can use I/O to do that in a way that we don't need to, in a way that's like more programmable, that we can have this like universal setup that we can gather randomness and anyone is able to use that randomness to do whatever they want with. So here's how we do it. So again, we have our I/O box. Okay, and our I/O box does some compute, and if the compute succeeds, it produces a signature of the compute. Okay, but in this case, it will also encrypt something, encrypt the output of the compute. Yeah, and it's also able to do like a decrypt. So this is kind of like similar to what Jordy was getting at. So it takes an input, it decrypts it, I want to put the compute at the end. I want to put the signature at the end. So it gets an input, it decrypts it, it does some compute on the thing, and then it encrypts it, and it signs it. And that's all that it does. This is our whole compute. So it takes an input, it does this, and it outputs the signature, and it also outputs the this out. Also outputs out. Okay. So like it's important to remember that like the I/O box is created with the process that we described at the very start. We have some like binary circuit. You like encrypt the binary circuit and you have this like encrypted circuit that you're able to execute, but you're not able to like understand or comprehend. You're able to do like black box stuff to it, but you're not able to see what's going on inside. So this is like the core API of I/O. And this is the thing that you like once we combine this with the ability to make signatures, we have this like authenticity that we're able to use to bootstrap basically the whole, almost everything that a trusted party can do. So like one way to think about this is that like you have like a trusted party, like I/O can be like a really trusted third party, right? Where you can just say to the I/O people, the I/O box, hey, do this thing and sign this thing and then just give me the signature. And because no one is able to see inside or affect what's happening inside, this becomes a really powerful tool that we can use to build like all the systems that we ever wanted. Like imagine that if you could really trust Facebook or if you could really trust like these internet services. That's kind of what we're getting at with I/O. Okay, so how do we do our random number generation? So basically what we do is we have this box and then we say to people that like, okay, you take a random number and encrypt it and put it into the box. And then inside the box, you encrypt it. I have to put the secrets here. So we have a public key and a secret key. These are secrets. So no one knows the, no one knows the secret key, but everybody knows the public key. So basically, the user encrypts for the public key. They put it into the I/O box. The I/O box does the compute, where it decrypts it. It combines it with the with the previous randomness that was. Oh, we need to have two inputs, right? One is not enough. So this is input from the user, and this is input from the current state. So you have two inputs. So it takes the input from the user, it decrypts it, it takes the input from the state, it decrypts it, it joins the two randomnesses together, and then it encrypts the output, and it returns that and assigns that. So this is the, so then what we do is we make it like a chain where like we have like this IO box kind of pass the value to the next one, which passes the value to the next one. And like what we're doing is that we're just stacking randomness up on top of itself, right? And this is kind of like phase one of our trusted setup, where we're generating this random number that no one knows. And like the assumption is that like if any single party includes, honestly passes a random number, then there's no way for anyone to know, like to calculate the random number, right? Because in order to calculate the final random number, you need to have all of the intermediate random numbers. Okay, so this is how you generate the random number. And then like we have to make another box to actually use the random number, because like with the trusted setups that we've historically done, they need to have a special property. It's not enough for them to just be like random or whatever. They need to be able to, they need to have this, like for the trusted, for the powers of tau, it needs to be like the g to the x equals g to, or gt to the x or something like that. I can't remember. But like it needs to have a special property. So we just make another IO box that does that. So the IO box has the same kind of like public key and secret key. So we have the same secrets. So it's kind of like these are two different trusted parties, and they're able to talk to each other. So this one encrypts some values for this one, and this one takes those values and does some stuff with them. And then we can have like our arbitrary compute here, and we do our compute, and it outputs the actual trusted setup. Great. Okay, how is this? Any questions? Yes.
I think secret key is included in IO box, but is it make able that no one knows that secret key?
Yeah, that's an important property here. That we have to make sure that no one is able to know the secret key, and that's one of the properties that we get from the like the encryption step at the very start. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is like a programmable encryption.
Oh, thank you. Mm.
Mm. Yep.
Hello. So if you are obfuscating the program, does the programmer have any advantage by knowing the actual program? And if so, like, how can other people agree that the program is correct if it's obfuscated?
Yeah, okay, so this is, I saw this in one of the, this is a question earlier that Vitalik didn't answer, but yeah, I think this is a good question. So basically, like in general, what we would do is we would publish most of the program. The only thing that we really care about hiding is what this person was getting at. That all we care about hiding is a private key. Like we're okay with someone, like the property of IO that we care about is not that the program is like indistinguishable, it's that the private key is indistinguishable. Like in most cases, we want to tell you everything about the program. We want to explain everything except the private key. Cool. Oscar?
So questions like some intuition for the blow up. So if you, let's say you implement CKPs with this IO box, and then if you have a more complex CKP, how does that relate to sort of the exponential blow up? Like what is a good intuition for how much size efficient it become as sort of the logic inside this box changes?
Oh, so it seems like you're asking two questions here. Like one of them is like, what's the overhead of IO? And the other is that like, could IO potentially be competitive with CKPs in terms of like prover time? Are you asking both or are you asking one of them?
Much more
on the logic inside the IO box?
Huh.
It's basically both questions that you mentioned.
Okay, let me answer both questions then. So the first question is that it depends upon the assumption. Like different IO schemes have different overhead. Like some of the more like extreme assumptions are actually pretty efficient in terms of execution. The setup is the main cost. But it remains to be seen. It's still very early, so I can't really give specific numbers or whatever. I'm not sure if, like, I suppose that, like, the thing that you're gaining from the IO ZKP is the succinct verifier. The verifier is really easy. It's just verifying a signature. So it's much less overhead than traditional zero-knowledge proofs, which tend to be, like, a couple of pairings. The best Grot16 or F-Flunk is like a pairing and like some other scalar moles and stuff. So it's better, it's faster verifier, but the prover time is likely gonna be like really a lot worse, at least in the short term. But it depends on the assumptions that we end up using or the basis that we're end up building things on. So it's not really clear yet. I don't think that zero knowledge proofs need to worry about anything anytime soon. I think that they are gonna remain, like this is more an example. Like this is more an example of what you can do. I'm not saying that like, oh, this is what we should do.
Barry, it's Q&A time.
Ah, okay. Sorry, Jordi.
No, it's great. That was the first question. I'll read them from the ones with the most votes, but feel free to not answer or skip to the next one.
Okay.
The top one is, can you explain IO as explain me like I'm five, and why do we need to use IO instead of other ZKPs?
You know what? Like, I feel like we got into so much trouble because we abused the zero-knowledge proof. Or name for such a long time, then that, like this question just, it's hard for me to understand what this means by like other zero knowledge proofs, because I suppose that this person is thinking that like, oh, they just have this blanket term for all like privacy technology and that's zero knowledge proofs. So I think that the key thing that IO gives is a non-interactivity. I think that like that's the missing piece of the puzzle.
But ZKPs that people use are non-interactive. I think the person doesn't understand that yet, that ZKPs cannot do everything, far from it.
Yeah. Zero knowledge proofs are a single player technology. IO is a multiplayer technology. This is what seems interesting about this.
We can take the other one, which is how do we get from weeks to seconds for IO?
I suppose we just have to like try more. We haven't really tried at all. I know, like we just need to work on it.
You heard that? Just go work on it. The next one is, what are exotic cryptographic assumptions?
Oh, I think they're like more like, do they want examples or they want like the vibe?
I just think they want to know what you mean by that.
So there's like standard assumptions, which are assumptions that people have made for a long time. All cryptography is based upon assumptions, because like there's this open problem in math that P is not equal to NP. And that basically means that like some things are hard and some things are easy. So because we're not able to prove that some stuff is hard and some stuff is easy, we're not able to prove that any particular thing is hard. And because we're not able to prove that any particular thing is hard, we have to base everything we're doing on assumptions. We assume that things are hard. So there's different things that people assume. There's things that people have been assuming for a long time, and people are much more open to these assumptions because we've been making them for a long time. But then there's newer assumptions that are more radical. And those are what I mean by exotic assumptions.
Yeah, and if you're interested in that, Brian Lawrence will give a talk about that in one of the workshops, the IO workshop. So there will be a talk about cryptographic assumptions. So that's it. We're running out of time. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, folks.
And with that, I will introduce our next speaker to the stage, Goopsheep. Goopsheep is one of the co-founders of ZeroXPark and the creator of Dark Forest. Please welcome him to the stage. Thank you.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for joining us this morning for the Programmable Cryptography CLS. The title of my talk today is Contact, and I'm going to be explaining a little bit about what that means shortly. As a quick introduction, I'm Goopsheep. I'm one of the co-founders of Dark Forest. I coined the term programmable cryptography about 2 years ago, and ever since then, we've been exploring a lot of its consequences. So this talk is going to be a little bit more of a mental models and frameworks talk. It's not going to be a whiteboarding session or a session where we go deep into the cryptography. We are going to hear more about the technology in this afternoon's workshops. And what we're going to do in this talk is, you know, we're going to look at some history and some worked examples of how we've come to build up even the ways that we think about programmable cryptography. At the end, we'll also tag on some highly uncertain speculation of what we might do with those frameworks in the future. Okay, so the title of this talk is inspired by a sci-fi series. This is the Culture series by Ian Banks. Raise your hand if you've read or heard of these books. Oh, actually, it's a pretty decent number. So the premise of the Culture series is that it explores adventures in this universe where this transhumanist post-scarcity society exists, and you know, it's sort of, there's a galaxy-wide culture of all of these humans or transhumans that are involved in this society. And one of the most interesting sort of agencies that exists in the Culture civilization is the Contact Division. And what the Contact Division does is they're the ones who are essentially at the frontiers or the fringes of the civilization, handling all kinds of interactions with any other extraterrestrial life or intelligences or things that they're finding at the fringes. And one thing that I kind of want to prompt is, what does it look like for Ethereum or applied cryptography or programmable cryptography to have a Contact Division? What does that look like? Okay, so let's first take a step back and ask, what are we trying to do here with programmable cryptography? The various organizations, the various individual contributors, the various people thinking about programmable cryptography, you know, what is sort of the goal here with programmable cryptography? We've seen a couple of instances of goals. Maybe it's realizing the real or the super real or the surreal. One framing that I really liked actually from Albert's talk, and that, you know, I've been thinking about a bit myself as well, is this idea of programmable cryptography as a fifth fundamental force. And as we saw in Albert's talk, cryptography represents a set of extraordinary new capabilities that would a priori seem impossible, much like how something like nuclear technology or the ability to harness electricity might have seemed impossible as well. And my question in terms of what are we doing here is, we're trying to figure out how to even grapple or come to terms with this. How do we even think about this? What does this enable? What are the right mental models for this technology? What will the different path dependencies be to realizing this? What are the right abstractions for the technology? And how do you design the interfaces between each level of the stack here? In short, you know, we have to grapple with the same problem that nuclear technologists had to grapple with, you know, in the last 100 years. Are we first going to make a bomb, or are we going to make infinite energy? And what are the sort of cross dependencies, both technologically and socially, that are involved in figuring that question out? Or something like computing. You know, it's very non-obvious in the days of something like the ENIAC, one of these giant room-scale computers, that the descendant of this 60, 70, 80 years out is going to be something like, you know, virtual worlds like EVE Online, where hundreds of thousands of people are battling in a virtual space reality for control of virtual space planets, right? How do you even begin to start thinking about what might take you from the left-hand side to the right-hand side? Okay, so there's a lot of stuff that we could do that wouldn't make sense. In particular, it's easy to rabbit hole down one particular kind of programmable cryptography technology, or to rabbit hole down like one particular sort of use case or product or something like that. But ultimately, it's really important to keep a solid head on your shoulders when you're approaching this question, because this is a decades-long civilization-scale technology, and we need to approach it and take it seriously as such. We need to build some foundations, mental models, in a way that takes seriously that a mental model needs to be useful on the time scale of potentially decades. That doesn't mean we need to get those mental models exactly correct today, but how we think about this should be credibly progressing us towards the goal of understanding how to think about this from a multi-decade civilization scale kind of scope. Now, the other thing you have to avoid while doing that is you have to avoid getting sucked into the perfect system trap, especially in a way that's not grounded in reality. So the other thing that we could do is we could be like, all right, programmable cryptography allows us to do this crazy stuff with Turing machines, with these crazy guarantees. Let's sort of sit down and theorize about that for a really long time and build some sort of like crazy like category theory, type theory, like, you know, correct by construction sort of thing. And then, you know, that's a real mousetrap too. We don't want to go down that rabbit hole. But somehow we still want to be making progress knowing that this thing has as grand of a scope as it does. Okay, so I want to talk about some of our thinking on how we've approached this problem over the last 5 years. So beginning about 5 years ago, we started to get the sense that there was something interesting happening in cryptography. We didn't have the words to describe it. We didn't have the frameworks. You know, nowadays people talk about the idea of, oh, you know, ZK enables data interoperability. That was not how we were thinking about ZK at all. When I started building a game called Dark Forest in 2019, the way that I was thinking about this was I had just learned about ZK snarks from Jordy, actually. And I had this idea, wow, you could use zero-knowledge proofs and blockchain to build this really specific and very strange game. So Dark Forest was a game built on zero-knowledge proofs on blockchain. It was one of, if not the first non-cryptocurrency application of zero-knowledge proofs. And it just seemed like a total one-off hack at the time. So we spent some time building Dark Forest, and what we came to realize was actually there was a general principle going on, which is that zero-knowledge proofs were not just enabling this one specific game construction, they were enabling this idea of incomplete information games, or games where players have some private state on a blockchain, or on a decentralized system where the whole state is public. So that enabled us to, you know, that came through building a bunch of other prototypes of some other games. This is a screenshot from a game we built called Boat Fight. And unlocking that realization allowed us to suddenly see what was going on with Dark Forest and this category of games. And suddenly it became actually a lot easier to build the different kinds of features and even figure out what kinds of features we could add into Dark Forest. So for example, you know, early on into the game, we introduced this idea of procedural generation. That was enabled by this mental model unlock of what ZK was fundamentally doing here. Okay, so then we get into, so Dark Forest was about 2020. This idea of incomplete information was about 2021. In 2022, we started experimenting with, wait a second, can we apply this principle across a bunch of other kinds of domains, not just games? So, you know, we built a bunch of these circuits. We built, we had folks in the Xerox PARC community and ecosystem building things like private message boards. ZK REPL over here is a developer tool for working with zero-knowledge proofs. There's Stealth Drop, which is like private airdrops. And we got the sense that what was going on was, you know, the common thread between all of these things and between the game thread was this idea of programmable privacy, right? And I use privacy in quotes here because I sort of am referring to a specific connotation of privacy, which is, oh, I want to hide something. I want to have anonymity or pseudonymity or something like that. And we kind of distilled this down into this idea that ZK snarks turn cryptography problems into programming tasks. It was much like what Vitalik was sort of saying in the morning, where we don't, you know, need a cryptographer to invent for us a new protocol for every feature. You can have someone write code and compile that into cryptography. Okay, so from there, once we had this notion of programmable privacy, we were like, well, let's step on the gas pedal here. The point is now a bunch of people can make privacy-preserving applications, and those people specifically don't have to be cryptographers. So we got a bunch of people together, started bringing folks into this ZK ecosystem, and we produced things like the first zero-knowledge machine learning demonstrations, stuff like Hanon with pseudonymous or anonymous speech, Ethos, which was the first demonstration of recursive ZKPs in a consumer social graph kind of use case, things which would allow you to port RSA identities into zero-knowledge proofs. And so we did probably like, you know, 5, 10, 15 of these projects, and that's what got us to arrive at this other concept called proof-carrying data. The idea that actually the thing going on here with zero-knowledge proofs is not something about privacy or scalability. Like, yes, those things are very relevant, particularly in the blockchain context, but after building 10 or 15 of these apps, we realized that what the zero-knowledge proofs were fundamentally doing, that was a common thread in each of these apps, was they were enabling permissionless data porting from source A to destination B. So now you can move things like a GitHub identity or an email or anything like that from this from this origin source over to this destination without needing to call APIs or things like that. Okay, so that gets us to proof-carrying data. We built this framework called the proof-carrying data software framework. So this is a mental model that then got actually translated into a library and the beginnings of a software abstraction. And then we started building a bunch of stuff on proof-carrying data. So this is kind of the blind men and the elephant sort of thing. We were realizing that all of these eight things were instances of this common category. So a lot of our proof-carrying data experiments led us to Zuzulu, which was a community that wanted to adopt decentralized identities, cryptographic identities, work with cryptographic data. And we built this thing called ZooPass, which everyone here has used to basically claim their ticket, generate a zero-knowledge friendly identity, and store zero-knowledge friendly data. And we built a bunch of apps on top of this concept of proof-carrying data with ZooPass as one of our levers. So we have things like, you know, the frog game. You can make zero-knowledge proofs about your frogs. We had ZooPoll, which was a polling app for the ZooZaloo community that also expanded to a couple of other communities. ZooCast or ZooCat, which were these social, sort of private social message board apps for these communities, just these various different things. And we built a bunch of PCDs, proof-carrying data instances, and we tried to build a bunch of stuff with them, and then we ran into more limits. And then we started to factor out, well, what are the common threads where those limitations are holding us back? And this is what really led us to programmable cryptography. So, for example, with proof-carrying data and with ZK-SNARKs, we could only enable individual people to make proofs about operations on their own data. But there were a bunch of places where we would want, say, two people or multiple people to be able to jointly compute across data that I have in my ZooPass and you have in your ZooPass. And that led us to realize, oh, there's a very natural connection with these other kinds of general purpose programmable cryptography primitives, like multi-party computation and more. Another realization that we had was that even though we had this abstract concept of proof-carrying data, PCD, it was actually in practice really hard to use PCDs. What we'd have to do is we'd have to write one more bespoke circuit for every kind of cryptographic operation or every kind of, you know, proof-carrying transformation we wanted to do. And so we ended up with this whole repository of all these different circuits and PCD types. And we were back to kind of square one on, well, you do need a cryptography-aware developer in order to even be able to engage in this ecosystem. So that led us to programmable cryptography, which is the subject of this community-led session here today. And concretely, what it means to say, it led us to the mental model of programmable cryptography, or this way of thinking about programmable cryptography, is it allowed us to figure out what the problem was and what the capabilities would be what capabilities would be unlocked if we solved those problems. So, you know, me and Andrew, we took a look at all the stuff going on with PCDs, and we were like, well, this needs to become generalizable, and this needs to become much more flexible. So now we have Pod and Pod 2. As a result, which we'll learn about more today in the afternoon sessions, we have, if you can go to pod.org to see sort of the latest on that. And then we started carrying out other experiments to see, well, now that we've been led to this next line of investigation, what might we do if we take FHE or obfuscation or these other technologies to their logical conclusion? So this DevCon, if you've gone down to the Frog Hub, you might have seen this game called Frog Zone, which is, as far as we're aware, the first game where the backend is running entirely in fully homomorphic encryption. Like Justin mentioned, we've basically built this four-player game where you've got four frogs on a 32 by 32 grid. The frogs can move up, down, left, or right. They can collect items, slay monsters, etc. And all of that is happening inside of fully homomorphic encryption with 1 billion X overhead on top of what it would take to run this kind of a game normally on a, you know, plain text ordinary computer. And that's unlocked some really interesting thoughts, and it's sort of, that is one of the things that's actually led us to obfuscation. Because one of the huge pain points of building something like Frog Zone, if you've actually tried the game downstairs, is that there is a ton of interactivity. There's a ton of multi-party computation decryption that needs to happen. The Wi-Fi keeps going out downstairs. Our hardware switcher thing keeps failing. And so there's no way that you can take this technology and scale it to something like a billion people unless you bring in a non-interactivity technology like obfuscation. So each of these things has been essentially some sequence of figuring out what's really going on here, trying to generalize what we currently know, and looking for what is the general category of thing that this is, and how do we solve that problem. Each of these steps in the understanding tree for programmable cryptography has taken about a year, and each of them has been a concrete step towards a grounded conceptual framework for how to think about programmable cryptography and what you can do with it. So again, like I said in the beginning, none of these are complete frameworks. None of them are, you know, the end-all be-all of how to think about programmable cryptography, but each of them does build on each other, and we're starting to get hints that this might be a generally pretty good way to think about what you can do with this technology. You know, first starting with ZKPs let us build incomplete information games and decentralized systems, then generalizing that to saying ZK-SNARKs turn privacy math problems into coding problems, then generalizing that into ZK-SNARKs are about data interoperability, and as Vitalik said actually earlier, on a panel earlier this week, rather than calling them ZK-SNARKs, we might just call all of these things proofs. And then finally, we've come to this sort of model of programmable cryptography as this general purpose way to think about computation between a network of people. Okay, so in essence, what we've been trying to do over the past several years is build a machine to produce this kind of thinking. And what is the mechanism by which this machine operates? That mechanism is what I sometimes think about as contact with reality, right? So rather than sitting in a room and theorizing a bunch about what might be an interesting ZK system or what might be an interesting thing to put inside of a snark, we'll sit down and we'll build a lot of stuff. We'll take as much of that stuff as we can. We'll deploy it whenever possible in as real of a setting as possible, even if that's just to a few hundred or a few thousand users. And then we'll constantly go through this process of looking back, auditing, pruning, and synthesizing, and trying to figure out what is the general principle, what's the line that you can draw between all of these points. Here are some forms of what contact with reality might actually look like. One is building a first end-to-end prototype of some technology that we've never tried before. So something like FrogZone. Again, let's just try to put a server inside a fully homomorphic encryption, even if it's a billion times slower, and we'll figure something out. Another one is trying to build something that folks, for whatever reasons, will use or need or ideally love, even if it's a small group of just a couple of hundred people. Another one is teaching developers and providing them with different tools or SDKs or abstractions and seeing if that actually enables them to do some things that they couldn't do before or understand something that they couldn't do before, maybe even build something that we could not even have anticipated. If we can do that, then we have some sense that, oh, this abstraction is actually something that makes sense, that is maybe worth refining and building on top of. By the way, as sort of in reference to that last particular point, I think that folks at DevCon should think very hard about the fact that every DevCon attendee now has access to a ZK-friendly EDDSA and semaphore key. There's essentially, you can think of what will you do with the Merkle root of all DevCon attendees. In addition, thanks to the Frog QR code scanning thing that's been going on, there are hundreds of thousands of self-issued attestations now between attendees that form a dense social graph. Each of those Frog requests is essentially your key pair signing someone else's public key. Okay, so yeah, it's important to make a lot of stuff. Equally important is not to get distracted. So if something that we're building doesn't fundamentally make sense, but has the potential to make a lot of money or score really highly on some notion of model of metrics like users, knowing when that is not the right track to keep going down. Another thing that we think about is if we're really here with the goal of testing out a new mental model, not compromising on the mental model and getting that goal mixed up with something like adoption. It's better to have a test with 1,000 people that tests the right kind of framework or mental model than to scale to 10,000 or 100,000 in a way that is testing a different thing. Now, the ideal thing would be to test with 100,000 people with the right mental model, but that's what we're working towards trying to scale up. The last one is being willing to constantly reassess, resynthesize, and move on from things that don't make sense or aren't working. So we've had plenty of false starts in terms of how to think about what you can do with programmable cryptography. Okay, so with that, I want to talk about a couple of new mental models or frameworks that have come up even just through discussions over the last week with folks at DevCon. So one is, again, this idea that interactivity really kills. This is another one of those motivations for obfuscation. Like I mentioned, we've been running this Frog Zone game in the basement of DevCon. Four players can get around, and it's just a real difficult problem to get all four of the clients doing the decryption multi-party computation with every single operation in the game. Now, when we think about something like interactivity versus non-interactivity, that's something that doesn't sound as sexy as like, now I can do arbitrary programs on encrypted state. But it just turns out that for scaling these systems to millions or potentially even billions of people, you need some strategy for actually dealing with the fact that only the people involved in a computation should need to be involved in the actual process of running the computation. And an interesting connection that actually someone made at an MPFHE panel yesterday was, wait, maybe this is actually one of the reasons why ZK snarks have been such a powerful technology that's been so accelerated compared to FHE over the last years, especially with respect to blockchains. We've actually had general purpose zero knowledge proofs for a long time now. ZK snarks, one of the additional things is that they're non-interactive. You can make a one-shot publicly verifiable proof. And this is a thing that's actually unlocked a ton of use cases and a ton of actual, in the real world developer activity. Another one that I think about And I know I'm running out of time. I just have I have two more of these. One is this idea of global private state. So we've noticed that with things like FHE or MPC, you can build these decentralized applications that have state, you know, imagine like a variable or a location of a monster or something, where none of the participants in the application actually know that state, but the state is being computed on correctly. So in Frog Zone, there's monsters around the map that move around, but nobody knows where they're moving to or from. The servers and the machines are just sort of executing in fully homomorphic encryption, advancing the state of the game one step at a time. And the bat is just sort of its own like autonomous agent that's just moving around. You know, so one question is like, you know, I had a moment when we got the bat moving around on its own working where I was like, wait a second, like what is the subjective experience of this bat? Like, is this a new kind of agent? It's somehow moving around in encryption. There's literally no single computer or person or program in the world that knows where the bat is or knows anything about what it's doing. And yet it somehow has this like independent objective experience where it's doing its own thing. It raises a bunch of interesting questions about cryptography and agency, right? Like one thing that I think about also here is, you know, a cryptographic agent has a different flavor or affordance to it than an AI agent. A thought that then was prompted from that, from some other folks who looked at Frog Zone, was like, well, what's actually going on with encryption? We think of encryption as a technology for hiding messages, but maybe that's not what's actually going on, in the same way that zero knowledge, in many contexts, is not really about zero knowledge or hiding, it's about proving and it's about data interoperability. So maybe the thing going on with encryption here is, you know, if I mind uploaded my brain in encryption to, you know, some server somewhere in plain, not in encryption, in plain text to some server somewhere, the operator of that server would be able to do surgery on my neurons to really like fuck with my subjective experience. But if I uploaded my brain in encryption or in obfuscation somewhere, the only way for the person operating that program to mess with me specifically would be for them to essentially take down the whole system. Because now all of the gates describing my brain are intimately connected with the rest of the obfuscated program. You can either turn the crank on the entire program at once, or you can just like destroy it completely. That internal logic of the world is somehow preserved because of the fact that it's obfuscated. And the hiding thing comes out as an accidental property. So, you know, going back actually to one of the things Albert was referencing as well, there's this idea of we call something X because we don't yet know what to call it. It's pointing at the idea that the words that we're using to describe these systems are placeholders, and they represent the fact that we just don't have a better understanding yet. So we called it zero knowledge because we didn't know what to call it. Now we're moving to a world of something like proofs. Maybe we call it encryption because we don't know what to call it. And maybe it's actually about creating worlds with somehow mathematically unwindable codependencies between everything. Maybe we call it cryptography or programmable cryptography because we don't know what to call it. So that's it basically for Contact. You can find out more about what's next this afternoon. We will be talking about a bunch of these different systems that we've put into varying stages of production. Hopefully over the next couple years, we essentially take these mental models and we can start building out a lot more mature systems. And thank you, everybody. If you want a little froggy gift, feel free to scan this QR code as well.
It's not any froggy gift. This is most probably...